We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise one another. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful, but we have lost the way.
Welcome to Ungagged. This is Neil Scott, and as it's my turn to introduce the podcast, I'm going to give you one of my views on digital activism. Others will be along later in the podcast to give their views. We may overlap, we may disagree, but we respect each other's right to a different view. That's what Ungagged's all about. What has happened regarding our data and big business and the rich and their political parties and campaigns over the past few years is only really to be expected. Newsprint has less impact on people's everyday lives, though that impact is still significant. And as entertainment and escapism becomes the choice for the TV viewers, and the Reithian view of public service broadcasting drowned out in a sea of advertising, product placement and endorsements, news, education and the class of ideology is lessened. They need to use their money, control of the media and huge investment in enclosed social media platforms to try to control us. We are at present heading for the dystopia predicted in This Perfect Day, Brave New World and Blade Runner, as less and less people seem to care about the world and more about celebs and pulling the lid down on the outside world and dilating our pupils and mushing our brain inside a box set. Or are we? States across the world are investing in huge PR and misinformation exercises, but with strength in numbers rather than dollars. Regardless of how suppressed the news agencies are in reporting Israel, the phone recordings and photos of the dreadful attacks on Palestinian peaceful protesters in the past few days has shown the IDF up as the murderous ethnic cleansing operation it really is. If social media didn't exist or was policed and walled in by states as they want it to be, the murders of protesters running away would not have seen the light of day. What Scotland witnessed online, followed up by some MSM footage of the Catalan elections and the violence carried out by a Spanish government showing its fascist roots, is hopefully ensuring the democratic protection of Clara Ponsanti here within our legal system. Please look up Amar Anwar's Twitter account to find out how you can help that campaign. If social media didn't exist or was policed and walled in by states as they wanted to be, the violence carried out on voters would not have seen the light of day. What would have happened regarding Yes Scotland and Yes 2 following the fascist attacks on Yes supporters after September 2014 if social media didn't exist? Facebook and the rest of social media and the enclosed internet must change. Yes, our data must be protected. Cambridge Analytica is a wake-up call. But our ability to share news around the world must not be allowed to be policed by Tories in Westminster, Putin in Moscow, Murdoch from his estates, or other old threatened fat cats in their gold-flecked stretch pants. The left must use the new media to educate in new ways, not lecture. The days of lecturing leaderships of left groups controlling thousands of members are well over. A way forward? A solution? Well, in my opinion, social media sales and smaller groups in the real as well are the way forward. New networks of groups and individuals recording, commenting, writing, analysing, debating events, passing video footage, photos, articles, information across groups. Thesis and antithesis can still create synthesis with social movements uniting when needs be. We can't win the big bucks battles, but our numbers can mean we will win the information war against big money run alt-right websites, groups and the right-wing MSM highlighting lies and distortions and showing and explaining the truth. They have the money to target big impersonal numbers, populations hit by generic messages meant to enrage and control narrative and ultimately populations. We have the numbers to counter their shite, educate and pull down the electronic shutters on their lies. Anyway, on today's podcast, Liz Castro, the Catalan-based writer, tells us what is going on there. And we have contributions from around the world, from across the social media activist world, from Colin Parks, Nellie Neal, Deborah Torrance, Chuck Hamilton, M. Dehaney and Wee Rafe. Music comes from The Mighty Ur, Stephen Smith, Derek Stuart McPherson, Faber Whitehouse, Marshall Chipped, Steve White and Andrea Hines. This wee corner of online activism is almost entirely funded by those you hear on this podcast. Your contribution is really welcome. paypal.me/ungagged left. Please follow us on Twitter @_ungagged and on facebook.com/ungagged. This is the Baby Seals and Period Drama. Never, ever, ever happens.
Folks out there, George Collins here for another edition of Ungagged, and I hope you are doing well wherever and whenever you are listening to this program. The novelist Stephen March once posed a question in The Atlantic: is Facebook making us lonely? His thesis was that as social media proliferates, offering a unique and irresistible blend of distance and intimacy, evidence shows that people are feeling lonelier and more narcissistic than ever before. It's a fascinating piece in The Atlantic, and I recommend that you read it. And as a spoiler, his ultimate conclusion is that Facebook may not be the primary driver of increased loneliness in a good chunk of the population, but that it is creating new tendencies in the ways that we interact with others, tendencies that are unprecedented in the entirety of human history. And for those of us engaged in politics, critical thought, social activism, and the large tent that all of those activities fall under, we too are influenced by this new age of digital activism in ways that have not influenced activists of the past, and in ways that we may not consciously recognize. In watching a video by the YouTuber Vsauce, a fantastic commentator and teacher who explores questions that we may not often think about, for example, what would happen if the Earth stopped spinning all of a sudden? But that's an analysis for another time. There was one of his videos when he discussed the concept of social media, and he brought up a term, of which escapes me and that I was unable to find before this, that describes the tendency among those on social media, be it Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, whatever platform you prefer, to huddle into communities that they know will think like them and will validate their interests. And you might be saying, well, George, that's not new. People have done that even before the advent of Facebook. And that is true. You know, birds of a feather flock together is the old saying, right? Timeless. But did those tendencies before Facebook and other social media platforms have the effect on politics at large that we now see? I know people are tired of hearing about it at this point, but let's look at 2016 and the U.S. presidential election, understanding that there will be a whole shelf in political science libraries dedicated to analyses of that year. So it's still important to draw on lessons from it, because in my opinion, many of us on the left still have not taken the lessons we need to do take from it. There was all this shock about how people could support the horrendous image that Donald Trump represented, the arguments that he presented, and suddenly we were finding that there was a greater chunk of Americans than we thought who felt the way that he did and who resonated with the words that he spoke. But there's no reason that should have come as a surprise had we been conducting ourselves in a way that we on the left like to think we do. That being those who fight for the poor, who listen to the concerns of the oppressed, and who work to help these lift these people out of what journalist Chris Hedges once called the culture of despair. In his book, American Fascists, The Rise of the Christian Right and the War on America, Hedges analyzes this culture of despair, these people who turned to radical Christianity out of a sense of loneliness, out of a history of abuse, out of blaming culture at large for their misfortunes. And in doing so, they were compelled to join these cultish mentalities and to spur the rise of what we now know as dominionism, or the exertion of these right-wing values over the country at large in the interests less of allowing them to find the love of Christ and more in the interest of punishment. And this was a movement that has been brewing for years, and even if Donald Trump hardly represented any kind of a Christ-like or American prophet, we still could see this coming from a mile away. And I wonder how we might have been able to channel that proletarian rage into something different had we been listening. Instead of huddling away in our leftist groups on Facebook and only following those on Twitter we agreed with and who could give us that sense of pride that we were thinking the right thoughts when we wake up in the morning and check our Twitter feed on the phone. What if we had understood the arguments that people on the other side would have made? And I need to be clear, I don't mean the Richard Spencers of the world or the Nigel Farages or these people who are so obviously steeped in a culture and mindset of hate that reconciliation may not be possible. But what about the average voter, the average Trump supporter, the average Brexiter, the average person who voted for Modi in India, or who helped elect the new right-wing government in Italy, or any of Abe's supporters in Japan, Abe being a strong militarist who is looking to revive the military strength of that island. Do we believe, and are we so blind to class oppression that we would believe that all those people fall lockstep with the horrendous ideals that these people spur because of their position of power that the voters and supporters lack? I would like to think not. But in huddling in our own communities, which is not a bad thing, especially for those of us who face oppression who need to take solace, but for those of us who enjoy a fair amount of privilege, we have the ability, more than anyone else, to be able to speak to these people that we perceive as detestable or deplorable, to use Hillary Clinton's words, and to understand the culture of despair that drives them into such support in the first place. And as we act as digital activists, as we evolve as digital activists, a process that many of us, myself included, are still doing every single day, perhaps it would be worth it to, if not engage with every person we come across that we don't agree with, but to understand their argument. Now, let's be clear about something. Simply understanding an argument is not the same thing as validating it, agreeing with it, or elevating it in any way. You know, just because I'm sitting here drilling defenses to techniques in kickboxing doesn't mean that I would use every single technique that I'm drilling the defense for. There is a substantial difference there, and so I don't want this to be construed as all opinions are valid or that everybody deserves our time. Like I said before, the Richard Spence of the world, the Nigel Farages, I got no time for people like that. And if your time is worth anything to you, you don't either. If I could, you know, be my American self and use a war analogy, since my country is addicted to war, Sun Tzu in The Art of War once wrote that if you know the enemy and you know yourself, you need not fear the result of 1,000 battles. And in the political sphere, although I hate to use such jingoistic language, the same concept applies. If we know the arguments of those that we seek to convert and show the socialist way or the progressive way or however, whatever cause it is that you fight for, if we know what they will come at us with, and we know what we would respond with, we need not fear the result of 1,000 debates, whether that be waged on a Facebook thread or in a Twitter feed or on Tumblr or face-to-face in real life. Even if your endgame is not to fully convert and have recruited a new socialist or five by the end of the day, we can at least plant seeds, and people can change over time based on the accumulation of such seeds that are planted. I hate to use myself as an example, being the narcissist that I am, but I look back at the ways that my own thought processes have evolved and my beliefs and the ways that I understand the world. Especially when it comes to something like privilege. I used to be the borderline MRA, you know, white privilege isn't a thing, male privilege and patriarchy isn't a thing. I was the dorm room atheist, all right, that was me. The only reason I changed was after years of reading and participating in exchanges that forced me to think, that forced me to defend my position in a way and with an approach that I wasn't going to experience in my own communities that were going to tell me that feminism was outdated or that any amount of increased incarceration for blacks was justified. I'm not proud of those beliefs, but the only way I came out of them was by people taking the time to ask me hard questions and to challenge points and to show me evidence. Did it work on a dime? Well, no, because you can't turn an ocean liner on a dime. And back then, I was definitely as big as one. But over time, you can chip away, and who knows, that person that you were with on Facebook who dismissed you, who insulted you, you might have gotten in their head, and they might be thinking about that. It might be bothering them for the days to come. Hey, you don't know, but hey, worth a shot in my book. I don't think Facebook is making us more lonely, but I think it is making us more radical in our thinking and less ready to see the nuance that tends to manifest in everyday political thought among anybody who calls themselves left, right, center, independent, whatever label they want to slap on themselves or not. So let's continue to evolve as digital activists and become better rounded by resisting this tendency of the digital medium to not get us to talk to each other. We may be more connected than ever before, but how well do we understand the lives of those that live next to us every day? I could definitely improve in this regard, and I will continue to do so. And if you feel that you need to do so, I hope you will join me.
And this is our Western edition. Good evening. It began as an ordinary school day, and it was almost over when gunfire erupted this afternoon. This deadly mass shooting happened in Parkland, Florida, about 20 miles northwest of Fort Lauderdale at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, attended by about 3,000 students. A suspect was taken into custody about a mile from the scene. We're going to have much more on him in just a moment. We do have extensive coverage tonight, beginning with Manuel Bohorquez in Parkland. We do caution you, some of the video you're about to see is graphic.
He doesn't see the kids much anymore since he stopped turning a wage. He doesn't see the kids much anymore since he had to go away. But he's thinking about them today, and the dreadful news from the USA. Children in the crosshairs, peace singing, his thoughts and prayers. on a threadbare sofa lit by a TV that's always on. She hugs the kids tight as the news is read on BBC One. With their X Factor dreams of being someone, what would have happened that night if he'd had a gun? Her children in the crosshairs and other people's thoughts and prayers. No job, no home. He spent a few nights on the streets. The army gave him survival skills like they give you PTSD. And he remembers a fella from that first night by a busy tube, out of sight as the metro headline screams. Children in the crosshairs, send them your thoughts and prayers. She remembers her mother singing to her when she was young. And she hears the man in black as she puts the little un down. When I was a baby, my mother told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die.
Just as the school day was ending, the shooting started. His cell phone video captured the gunfire and the scream.
Children in the crosshairs. Children in the crosshairs. Children in the crosshairs. What use? Your thoughts and prayers.
Resilience by Neil Scott. My teacher taught me to be resilient today. I fell and I cried, and I was embarrassed she saw me. But my teacher said, life can be like that. Just pick yourself up and get on with it. It started out an ordinary day. I had to get to school. Dad had come round to the flat last night. Mama and Dad are not living in the same house. Ma's nerves are bad. Dad makes them bad. Me and Ian had been out looking for Ma. She goes out sometimes and forgets we can't get in. Somebody grasped and my dad came round and hit the door though. Ma was in the house after all. But she'd had some of her medicine and hadn't heard us. Dad shouted at her that he couldn't have the Waynes coming round to this in case he was reported to the social. And Ma flew at him with a bottle. Ian gets all upset when they fly at each other. I tell him to get behind the couch and get down. Dad caught the bottle on the arm and tell her that if she did that again he'd cut her. She said if he didn't get the bleep out, she'd have the police on to him. He just said, keep them Waynes off the street at this time of night or I'll have you seen to. He had her seen to one night outside the flat. That old woman at 9B came out and pelted the guys with clothes pegs and that, like that could help. But they ran away, and she brought Ma into her house. It was a really nice house, warm with lights. Ma was in some state, and they guys had taken her bottle. After she was fixed up, Ma and us went back to our flat, and Ma told us never to speak to that nosy old buddy again. When Dad went back out of the flat, Ma gave me a leathering. Why the bleep did you go to that bam? she shouted. I say bleep because I don't like bad words. Ma and I say them all the time. They fly like broken bottles across the street from their gobs when they see each other. After she leathered me, I don't cry, because that can make it worse. She told me she was sorry and things were bad, and that I was a pretty wee thing. Her wee Nora. Anyways, Ian and me, we went and slept in the same mattress in the other room. We've a duvet each, and we can share. I don't sleep all through the night. Sometimes it's because Ma is singing and dancing after her medicine. Sometimes it's just because I'm listening out for Da. I woke just when the light was starting, and I crept through to see where Ma was. She wasn't in the flat. Our flat isn't warm. It isn't light. Sometimes people in school talk about when they get up and go out of bed, and they get their breakfast from their Ma, and they have a shower and stuff. Our Ma isn't like that. We do get showers, especially when the social worker is coming. But Ma hasn't been good in the past weeks. She gets the depression. The water is cold, and I make Ian wash his oxters and face and horns. Ian is older than me, but he has special needs. Or the depression. They seem the same to me. Our school uniform isn't in the flat. And I know what Ma has done. She's done it before and promised not to. The social will be ruined later, because the only thing I have to go to school in is a pair of shorts and a vest. Ian has a ripped pair of jeans and a Power Rangers pyjama top. She mustn't have been able to fit her welly boots into the plastic bag last night, or maybe people don't want to buy wellies. She calls it robbing Peter to pay Paul. Paul must be the skinny man who she gets her medicine from. When we're leaving, I leave the door on the latch. Ma might not have remembered her key, and if she has a lot of medicine in somebody else's house, she might not be home till the morrow. The school isn't too far. I don't know the time, but I know when the morning rolls are being delivered to Detsy's. It's near breakfast club time. When we get to the school, Charlie, the breakfast club guy, said, "Yous must be freezing." And he gets his uniforms, socks and trainers. People in the school give them in when they're too wee for them. He lets me choose, and I choose the ones that look the oldest, so Ma won't try and sell them again. Breakfast Club is great. Walking in here, into this big new building, with its big hall and light and warm, and things to do, is like sunrise. It's like when I had a torch and I was able to light our room one night when it was scary. This place is the only place my forehead doesn't feel tight. Sometimes I feel so happy here. I get a bit out of control and the teachers shout at me. But it's no like Da or Ma shouting. It's safe shouting. One of the times I do feel bad is when people are getting points for bringing in their homework. I never have mine done. I can't do it, I don't have time. You don't get told off for not doing it, but it's like one of Ma's slaps when Kylie Loft gets points. She's horrible. She wouldn't give me a share of her big bag of Doritos last Tuesday, even when she gave Maisie, Tina and Mohammed some when we were playing Tig, because she says, "Nora never shares anything." I wish I did have some stuff to share. I feel bad when it's my birthday, and the teachers sing happy birthday, because I never have a cake or sweets to give the class. Our teacher is nice. But I wish she'd stop giving points for things my Ma and Da can't do, like best costume on World Book Day, or for wearing all your uniform, or for healthy snacks or home learning projects. I don't mind people getting points, I suppose, but all them projects are mostly done by people's Ma's. Their Ma hasn't got the health my Ma has. I can never get points. And that's like a punch in the stomach sometimes. The school dinners are best. I pretend I hate them like Tina does. I know Tina loves them like me. Where'd you get food like that? It's all different colours. Things you don't get normally in the chippy or out of tin. Mr. Singh behind the counter likes me. He gives me extra stuff and winks. Anyways, after lunch, it was going to be circle time. I I like afternoons and all, but I get a wee bit sad because I know it's nearly time for home, and I know it'll be cold, and I know my mum wouldn't be there. And sometimes I get angry at my friends because they have nae Ian to look after, or Ma to clean, or Da to hide from. And on the way to the stairs in class, I tripped and I fell, and I didn't want to get up. I wanted Mrs. Madigan, the classroom assistant, to pick me up and give me a wee cuddle and tell me things would be all right. Mrs. Madigan says, we have a jar that you have inside of you and it should be filled with cuddles and love. And when you feel sad, you can use one of the cuddles and the pieces of love from your jar to keep you going. But our teacher came back just before Mrs. Madigan and told me to get up and taught me resilience. Resilience is when you pick yourself up and brush yourself down and start all over again, so my teacher says. I count the cuddles and love going into my jar. I don't have much in there, but when I get them, I clamp the lid down tight and I remember them and I remember them, because I know that one day Ian and me might need them.
We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise one another. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful, but we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned many souls.
To understand what put us to find some common ground. Where together we might stand, cause maybe we can make a change, but we got to stand up, need to engage. Whether we leave or we remain. Yeah.
What is digital activism? Well, there are so many facets and possibilities for networking and expanding reach. I'm better telling you what it is not. Digital activism is not sitting at a keyboard waiting for someone to post something on their timeline so you can go and give them a piece of your mind and inform them of how wrong they are. Digital activism isn't trolling folk to remind them how awesome your points of view are. And most definitely, digital activism isn't launching a blog site and immediately following it up with crowdfunders to fund your digital activism. Just a quick FYI to all you DAGs, digital activist gurus. This public service announcement was brought to you in part via the internet, via a platform that is asking for some cash. Stop by PayPal, give us some spare change, not those other digital activist websites. Visit www.leftungagged.org for more details. Thank you!
Mother of two, teacher, lefty, inadvertent blogger and contributor to Ungagged. My two boys, aged 9 and 8, like the majority of kids their age, are obsessed with Fortnite. For those of you who have not heard of it before, Fortnite is a computer game where players have to survive on Earth following a sudden worldwide storm. 98% of the population have disappeared and zombie-like creatures have risen to see off those left behind. I still can't quite believe that my kids are not into In the Night Garden anymore. Anyway, by August 2017, Fortnite had over 1 million players and this has continued to grow. It is massive. The thing is, I haven't let my kids go near it yet, so why am I stalling? Problem is that certain games turn my huggy, lovely kids into utter demons. This is an experience that has been echoed by my parent friends. I'm by no means perfect in denying them this. I love the 10 minutes or so I get for a brew, a wee or just a bit of peace, just before World War III erupts over a bad bit of gameplay by one of them. But I do have a number of concerns. Shabana Arif, in an article posted on IGN, and yes, I know they're criticised for their reviews, but she makes a valid point, speaks of the rise in students attempting to play Fortnite in classes since the Android version has arrived. And this is largely anecdotal, but most parents will know the struggle of trying to get the kids off any game. I'm not just talking about Fortnite here. I can see that games started to break, that are so addictive, need to be finished. One of my younger pupils, aged 12, in the middle of his assessment, asked if he could find my kids on Fortnite and play against them. You can imagine my response to this quite genuine ask. But are these kids those ones that are likely to be distracted anyway? Psychologists talk about the basic building blocks of intelligence. Mental processes like perception, attention, memory and decision making, and that they can be improved by gameplay. In research, where gamers and non-gamers compete on a range of cognitive and perceptual tasks, gamers continually outperform non-gamers. Could those attracted to games already have a superior development of those skills? Peter Gray, writing in Psychology Today, a bit of poetry there, shares that gaming has improved diverse conditions such as lazy eye, mental decline due to ageing. It's proved more successful in improving dyslexia than many specific programs for dyslexics. It has positive effects on executive functioning skills, increases mental flexibility, and that's the ability to move from one task to another quickly and effectively. And this is a common challenge for those on the autistic spectrum. Two friends have shared the positive effects gaming have had on their children. One friend's son has Tourette's. Anxiety makes his tics quite severe. Playing on his iPad distracts him from his anxieties and lessens his tics. Another, whose son has Asperger's, spoke about how via Xbox Live he comes into his own. He is confident and witty when communicating with others. Other friends comment that when playing games, their kids are not on the streets getting into trouble. It does seem like a safer option. I'm still stalling. And it's because of these worries. I worry about how my kids become zombified by the games. I worry about their aggression when they've been playing for too long or when one of them frigs up in some team player game they're on. I worry that my kids play less and less outside or with Lego and miss the hundreds of drawing they used to do. But is this just their age? I also worry about the values they might develop as a result. Women are often portrayed as weaker characters, though I did used to love kicking ass playing as Chun-Li. Will they become desensitised to the violence that they see? But then I see those who have campaigned as part of hashtag never again. These young people who have always known a world with these video games have stood strong against violence. They have more compassion for humanity than many adults. I struggle to argue that video games make violent people. There are many other determining factors. Abuse, poor parenting, sadistic streaks, lack of compassion, low self-esteem and disaffection. These traits and vulnerabilities shape a person's interpretation of games and films and books. I still have concerns as a teacher for the effect on academic success. Many of my students over the years have arrived at class tired after a night's gaming, grey-faced and exhausted. They're in no fit state for a lesson on pre-19th century poetry. 2 hours plus of screen time, and this is including TV and internet as well as the games, has a direct effect on the ability to go to sleep and the quality of the sleep that they have. Those who become addicted to gaming will skip homework, for example, you know, losing their opportunity to deepen their understanding. They soon start to fall behind their peers. Again, this 2 hour plus time can be directly linked to childhood obesity, back pain, headaches and carpal tunnel syndrome, pain and numbness in hands, wrists and elbows. I'm still confused. I go from gaming is wonderful to wanting to burn them all in a wicker effigy. There is so much conflicting evidence. I'll finish with Dr. Daphne Bevelier. I think that's how you pronounce her name. She's an expert in the field of brain and cognitive science, so she should know what she's talking about. Her presentation for TED compared the playing of video games on the brain to wine on your health. To summarise, there are many poor uses for wine, and I can personally vouch for that, and poor game use. However, consumed at the right age, in reasonable doses, wine can be good for your health. Video games have many ingredients that are great for brain development. So, I've sort of made a decision. I will buy Fortnite, and whilst I let my boys play for a limited time, I will monitor usage while supping a glass of wine. Well, why can't we all get a little benefit out of this?
It stands out on the highway like a creature from another time. It inspires the baby's questions.
What's that?
For their mothers as they run.
17 years old with a baby on the way. Scared for his future, so he got up, then he ran away. Left her in the night, and then he was gone by the break of day. He only slept with her to prove to his mates that he wasn't gay. But he got a text a few nights later explaining that she had something else to say. That something more happened after they decided to fornicate. Turns out he left something more important than a pair of shoes. But the next revelation makes him want to jump out of a plane without a pair of shoes. I'm pregnant, she says, and there's evidence here that you can't refute, which planted a seed of fear in his belly, with intestines being the roots. Come over and see me, I beg, because there's too much stuff going on right now and I can't keep it all in my head. But he didn't know what to do, so he locked his phone and left a message on red. Then he sees his life rolling down a hill like two children on a sled, looking down the barrel of a gun at a shadow of a life that he never led. And in the future, when his child asks mummy about their dad, this is the story that she said.
He stands out on the highway like a creature from another time. It inspires the baby's questions.
What's that?
For their mothers as they ran.
So he left, not just the baby, but his own home too. Because nowadays his mum couldn't look at him the same way whenever he decided to roll through. It's the worst feeling in the world when your own mother wants to disown you. Now how hard she worked to raise you, and you want to give that to your own you. But you know that ain't a possibility, cause he's still 17, so being a good dad is still an incapability. And in the back of his mind, he doesn't even see it as his responsibility. But his mates told him that a girl couldn't even get pregnant if she was only just losing her virginity. So he packed his bags because he knew he wasn't ready to be a real dad, crying at the bus stop thinking about all of the dreams that he once had. If you told him he was going to be a father, he would have laughed at you and just called you mad. Although there's still a part of him that in the back of his mind is almost glad, because now he knows to be careful in the future. But that comes at the detriment of somebody's now. Left her alone with a baby and she can taste the tears rolling into her mouth. And now she has to come to terms with the fact that she's raising a baby in an empty house.
It stands out on the highway like a creature from another time. It inspires the baby's questions.
What's that?
For their mothers as they run. It stands out on the highway like a creature from another time.
Hi, this is Liz Castro. I'm a writer and an activist for Couple on Independence, because I believe that every people has a right to determine its own political future. And I wanted to give you an idea of what's been going on the last week, 10 days in Catalonia. It's really astounding, all of the things that have happened. But before we get there, I want to give you a quick rundown on exactly how we got. Well, not exactly, because it goes back hundreds of years, but we'll start on October 1st. October 1st, Catalans insist on having a referendum to democratically, peacefully choose their own future. Spain has tried to do everything in its power to stop that referendum. It has threatened people. It has arrested people. It has confiscated ballots. It's looked for those ballot boxes everywhere it could, couldn't find a single one. People come out, vote en masse, and Spanish police actually beat peaceful voters at the polls. Everybody saw it, saw the videos. On October 3rd, in response to that violence, there's a massive general strike in Catalonia. There have been many general strikes over the years, but this one was one that was really amazing for the amount of people who came out in support, both in favor of independence and just in favor of democracy. On October 10th, the Catalan president comes to the parliament and declares independence, but it turns out that he's been offered negotiation by who knows who. And so he suspends that declaration just as he declares it, in the hopes that they will be able to find some kind of political response to this issue. But the offers of negotiation are either false or they don't end up materializing. And October 16th, the Spanish judge calls two leaders, peaceful, nonviolent leaders of two huge civil society organizations, before the court and actually jails them. They have been in jail ever since October 16th. On October 27th, again, the parliament meets, and this time again declares independence. But at the same time, we know that the Spanish Senate is meeting in Madrid and has decided to dissolve the Catalan parliament, depose the Catalan president and all of the executive, and call new elections. Now, this is an unlawful application of Article 155, according to Javier Pérez Royo, who's a Spanish constitutional scholar, professor in Seville. He's not Catalan. He describes how Article 155 was specifically written to be used as a temporary measure, and it's absolutely beyond its scope to be dissolving parliaments and calling elections and deposing presidents, things that are certainly not temporary in any form. Spain says, okay, well, you know, we're just going to call new elections. It doesn't have the power to do that, but it does instead. And the Catalans respond by saying, okay, fine, you want to go to elections, we'll go to elections. And between the end of October and December 21st, when those elections are on a Thursday, Spain called them the soonest possible day, certainly pressured by European leaders, would be my guess. There's this onslaught of publicity, of propaganda against the Catalan independence movement and in favor of the unionists. We see their pictures everywhere. They're on all of the Spanish media. Spanish media practically doesn't have an independentist appear, whereas the Catalan media is much more balanced. And in these new elections, Spain is thinking about these new elections as a way to impose the government. And Spain invites, this is a very important point, Spain invites the Catalan independentists to run in these elections. It invites Carles Puigdemont to participate in the elections. He is already in Brussels. It invites Jordi Sánchez, who's in jail in Madrid, to participate in those elections. It invites all of the former, the people who were in the executive that they had dissolved, to participate in those elections, because the Spanish government believes that it will win. But in fact, on December 21st, the Spanish government loses. Its own party, the Partido Popular, loses I don't know how many seats in the parliament. It only has four. It's the party that receives the least amount of votes in Catalonia in those elections. And these are elections with the highest participation to date in Catalonia. It's incredible how many people come out. And still, while it's true that Ciutadans, which is a partially unionist party, which is not in agreement with even the Partido Popular, they're the ones who win the most votes, but partly that's because most of the vote of the Partido Popular go to Ciutadans, because the Partido Popular is seen as a corrupt party that's incapable of dealing with Catalonia. But Ciutadans does not win enough to form a government, certainly not in a parliament with seven different parties. And the only people who do have enough votes to form a government are the pro-independence parties. There's three of them. The Junts per Catalunya, which means Together for Catalonia, the Catalan Republican Left, and a group called the CUP, which is a farther left party. So those three parties have the votes to form a government. But then what happens? The Spanish government says, oops, but actually, even though we invited Carles Puigdemont to run in those elections, he can't really be president. We changed our mind. Because, you know, he's in Brussels, and the rules say that he has to be physically in the parliament to become president. That's not actually true. The rules do not say that. The rules don't say anything about him having to be present. And so the Catalan parliament calls a plenary session on, I believe it's January 30th, to invest Carlos Puigdemont as president, and the Spanish government comes out threatening to, threatening measures against whoever should allow that to happen, because they say that that is not legal. And in fact, the I forget if it's the Supreme Court or the Constitutional Court has a ruling that says that goes beyond what was even asked for, it's constitutional scholars all over Spain are shaking their heads at this incursion into the Catalan autonomy, because it's the Catalan parliament that has the sole right to choose who should be the president, and Carlos Puigdemont is the person who has the votes, has the support, and is a member of the parliament and should have been elected. But the Catalan parliament backs down and says, okay. And then they say, okay, well, I guess we'll decide, we'll try to have Jordi Sánchez be the president. Jordi Sánchez is in the jail in Madrid. He's the former president of the Catalan National Assembly, a grassroots, nonviolent, volunteer group of people whose mission is to win Catalan independence by peaceful means. And again, this time, the Spanish court says, oh, no, we're not going to let him leave jail to preside this campaign for president in the parliament, even though back in the 80s, they did allow an actual terrorist to go to the Basque parliament as the candidate for the presidency. They did let that guy out, but they wouldn't let Jordi Sánchez out because he actually had a chance of winning. Again, completely manipulating their own laws. There's no rule of law in Spain. There's the rule of the Partido Popular. So that brings us very quickly up to last week. Jordi Sánchez finally says, okay, and the parliament, you know, with all of their negotiations, says, okay, well, I'll back off. And so how about we'll try Jordi Turull. Jordi Turull was the former spokesperson for the Catalan government before it was deposed by the Spanish government. And he had been in jail for a month or so at the end of October, November. I forget exactly when, but he was released. And as they're talking about whether Jordi Turull can be the candidate for presidency, and of course he can because he was elected a member of parliament and he has every legitimate right to run, the Spanish judge says, oh, by the way, we've decided that we're going to call all of the former leaders to the court again and revise their bail conditions. And that includes Jordi Turull, of course. So they call them to appear before a Spanish court on March 23rd. That's last Friday. On Wednesday, the Catalan parliament says, all right, we're going to have a vote on Jordi Turull before you call him before the court. And so they schedule a plenary session for Thursday, March 22nd. In that plenary session, the CUP decides that it can't vote for Jordi Turull because it's not at all sure how... It doesn't have the confidence that Turull will go ahead with declaring the republic as the CUP wants, and as it considers that the mandate of the people is. So Turull actually doesn't win the presidency on that first vote, but had the parliament been able to have a second vote on Saturday, he would have won. But instead what happens is that night, Thursday night, three members of the parliament give up their seats. These are Marta Rovira, the president of the Catalan Republican Left, Carme Forcadell, who's a member of the Catalan Republican Left and who used to be the president of the Catalan Parliament in the previous session, and Dolors Bassa, who is the former minister of social affairs. They each give up their seats because they know they will be called before the Spanish judge in the morning, and he is going to use the fact that they are members of the Catalan Parliament to put them in jail, literally. In the morning, we find out that Marta Rovira has gone into exile. She has a young daughter. She writes a letter. It's a heartbreaking letter that says, I am a mother, and I need to be a mother to my child. I know that I will not get a fair hearing in Spain, and so I'm compelled to go into exile. But Carme Forcadell and Dolors Bassa and the rest of the members of the Catalan government and members of parliament who were involved in holding a referendum appear in court on Friday morning. And the judge decides that all of them should be kept in jail awaiting a trial on rebellion charges. Now think about rebellion charges in Spain for a moment. Rebellion means that they have conspired to overthrow the constitutional order by means of violence. By means of violence. Now there is no instance when any of the people who are currently being held in jail, or frankly anyone of any leadership in the Catalan independence movement, has ever demanded any kind of violence at all. None. Zero. We do not want to win independence by violence, because we want to create a new country in a peaceful manner, in a democratic manner, in a political manner. That's the way that we want to create this new country. We don't want to create it on the foundation of bloodshed. And in fact, that's why Puigdemont suspended the Declaration of Independence on October 10th, because the threats of violence from Spain were so intense, and he wanted to make sure that no violence occurred. So in every instance, the Catalan leadership has backed off of any situation involving violence. And so for the Spanish judge, Llarena, to accuse the Catalan leadership of a violent uprising, of a violent rebellion, flies directly in the face of any facts of the case. And in fact, there is... in the decree that he published, the Spanish judge published about Junqueras, it literally says, we know that he committed no violence. We know that he incited no one else to commit any violence. However, since he knew that the Spanish government would resort to any means to maintain its unity, including the use of force, he's responsible for the Spanish state's use of force. That's pretty incredible to accuse someone of rebellion because of the Spanish state's use of violence, not the Catalans. That is the key question here. So, and that just gets us to Friday. So Friday, the Spanish judge jails five additional members of the Catalan parliament. These are Raúl Romeva, Jordi Turull, Josep Rull, Dolors Bassa, and Carme Forcadell. They are all members of the previous government. They are all members of the current Catalan parliament until they gave up their seats. And not all of them have. And then he renews the European arrest warrant for the members of the Catalan leadership who are in exile. And there are seven people in exile right now, including Carles Puigdemont, the president of the Catalan government. Now, remember that the European arrest warrant had been rescinded by Spain this is the second time that they issued this European arrest warrant. They tried to get Belgium to extradite Puigdemont and the other members of the Catalan government who were in Brussels. But the Belgian government, when the Catalans turned themselves in and said, look, this is our situation, the Belgian government was going to reject the extradition request. And that's when Spain rescinded the request so that Belgium wouldn't be able to reject it. Because if Belgium rejects the extradition request, that means that Spain can't try those political leaders on these crazy rebellion charges. So now Llarena says, okay, well, we're going to try the European arrest warrant again, now that Puigdemont is in Finland. Puigdemont leaves Finland, tries to get back to Brussels, but is apprehended in Germany on the way. On Sunday morning, he is arrested by the German police and taken into custody. And now Spain has managed to internationalize the Catalan independence process so much better than we activists were ever able to do, because now Germany must make some kind of a statement about the Catalan right to peacefully, democratically choose its own future. If it agrees with Spain that it should return Puigdemont, it is saying that to a country where Puigdemont is accused of things he did not commit, that everybody knows he did not commit, that there's no evidence that he committed, that in fact the Spanish government doesn't even say he committed. Everybody knows that Puigdemont has committed no act of violence and has asked no one to commit any act of violence. So how could Germany return him to a trial for a rebellious uprising, which must by law include violence? It did not, so he didn't do it. The question is whether or not Spain is trying to get him to be brought back on charges of misuse of public funds. But in fact, the Spanish government itself says that not a single euro was used to pay for the Catalan referendum. And in fact, it was the Spanish government took over Catalan finances on September 20th and insisted that no Catalan government money had been used for the referendum. So how can they now accuse Puigdemont of using Catalan money to pay for the referendum? It doesn't make any sense. The only thing that makes sense is they cannot abide that the Catalans want to have their own voice about their own future, and so they're willing to make up and manipulate the court proceedings and now get Germany involved. So will Germany agree with Spain on these charges, or will it reject the extradition request and let Puigdemont go free? Or will it do something in between? And that's what we're not sure. At the same time, we have Clara Ponsatí, who is in Scotland. She's a professor of economics at St. Andrews University, also fighting the extradition request that the Spanish government has presented to the UK government. She has received massive support from St. Andrews University, where she is a well-respected, valued professor. And she has also been able to crowdfund something like £200,000 to pay for her legal defense in less than 24 hours. The outpouring of support from people in Scotland and around the world for a professor who was called to participate in the Catalan government, and her only crime is to help facilitate a democratic vote, that is not rebellion. The in the end, what we have to decide, in my mind, is that peaceful democratic mobilization around a referendum is not rebellion. Rebellion is when you try to overthrow a government by force, by violence, by arms. And that is precisely what the Catalan government has insisted on avoiding over and over again, to its own detriment. In many ways, it has backed off of the Declaration of Independence in the Catalan Parliament because it wanted to avoid violence. It has backed off not once but twice. It received promises of negotiation from Donald Tusk, for example, which were not forthcoming. That was a lie, or it was, I don't know, it was smoke and mirrors. Who knows? But the Catalans have done everything that they can to make this a peaceful process. The Spanish have not. And we saw that evidence on October 1st when they came in and beat those peaceful voters. So it seems to me that it's the responsibility of democratic people everywhere to stand up and say, people have a right to choose their political future peacefully. That is what the Catalans have been trying to do. And that is not what Spain has facilitated. And also ask this question, after all of these years, after 7 huge, massive demonstrations showing the ample support in the Catalan society for independence, why is it that Spain refuses to listen, to ask what is going on, to ask what is the problem, to make any attempt at conciliation, at negotiation, at listening? And that is the key, the foundation to the whole thing, that one of the reasons that this movement is so strong is because Catalans feel that they have no voice in their government, that the state government does not listen to them. And so each time, each attempt to get them to listen is met with deaf ears and scorn and manipulation and even violence from the Spanish state. And so Catalans feel that there is no future for them within Spain. There is no future in a country that does not listen to its people. And so the only option is independence. This does not end here. Catalans are adamant on having the freedom to express their own political views, and they have a right to that. And so, you know, we'll see what's going to happen in the next coming weeks. I don't think personally it should be, it's a question that should be resolved by the European countries, but it sure would be nice if we continued to have the support that we're beginning to see, at least among the people, if not among the member states. And there's one last thing, which is sometimes unionists say, ha, you know, after your declaration of independence, you've got no European support whatsoever. Well, first of all, that's not true. There's actually a fair bit of support in Europe and in the world for this peaceful, democratic political process. But also, whether or not European member states give support to Catalan independence is not does not determine whether Catalans have the right to self-determination. In fact, the lack of support from European member states is more a reflection of their own inability to support human rights. And that's something that Europe should look to fixing in its own house. But whether or not Europe supports Catalan independence does not determine whether Catalans have a right to independence. Every nation has the right to self-determination, particularly when it is receiving, when it is on the receiving end of the kind of violent oppression that we are seeing now from Spain, having its democratically elected political leaders put in jail for their ideology. That is not okay. That is not what happens in a 21st century democracy. Thank you for listening. I hope that's been helpful. Feel free to ask me any questions you like. I'm on Twitter quite a bit at Liz Castro altogether. Thanks. Okay, bye.
Gas pump comments. Rag and Bone Man, the ghostly cacophony of hawkers and commuters in bowlers, punctured plastic footballs out of reach beyond the fenced off rail lines, haunted houses, derelict houses, newlyweds with bright futures collecting Tupperware, shopping for Supperware, the death of industry, the end of rent and the birth of right to buy. Cold War spy sagas and Harold Robbins. Bodice rivers, titbits, pans people and limp wrists, pansies and comedy feminists. Kids in blazers, men huddled around braziers, hot metal presses and Laura Ashley dresses. Boot boys and butlins, Brian Riggs and Miss Whiplash, Whitewash, Whitehall Farce and Mary Whitehouse, Cockney pugilists, Northern ventriloquists, situationists, Grub Street hacks and dirty Raymacs, Kojak and hijacks, Bobby Sands and Grandstand, Alison Gibbs doing handstands in the playground, the IRA, the MFI, soccer yobbos and red rubber, red rum and humdrum sundaes, ice cream sundaes, chicken in a basket, pizza in a briefcase, kiss chase. I heard the bomb at Woolwich Barracks, the galloping gourmet and Fanny Craddock, Robin Day and Peter J, neoliberalism, male grooming. If you want a coloured for a neighbour, then vote Labour. Love thy neighbour. Mind your language. White men in turbans and primetime sitcoms, shin guards, RA bombs and horse guards. Strategy and tension doesn't warrant a mention, just as OPEC doesn't have an impact on Dennis Healy's tattered knees. Take it. The lagered up stars of Saturday can't even beat the polls these days. Bobby Moore's heroic hollow legs, They seem a million miles away these days. Boot boys make away days seem like door raids by the Red Brigade. Lou Grade gives way to Michael Grade. And it all slowly begins to fade. As the Iron Lady patiently waits for the fire sale, for the yard sale, the bonfire of all sanity, the end of society, and the slow birth of austerity. It's not so much the rivers of blood, but the sewers of hate that gush like the forgotten fleet beneath the satellite towns and the sinker states. And the inner cities are ablaze these days, not helped by the cop tightening the thumb screws with a sly smile upon his face. They wonder why we're aimless. They wonder why we're rootless, why we're nihilistic and dead-eyed. But they do not mention the seeds of their strategy of tension to keep us even violent and predatory or muted and sedentary. And it seems surely inevitable, even evolutionary, that some evil emissary will cap off this age of Shiva with the greatest light show that the world has ever seen, that the world will ever see. Fatal, inevitable jolt, and all eyes shall be blinded by the flash of Shiva's lightning bolt. This is a strategy of tension. This is their strategy of tension. This is their strategy of tension. This strategy of tension. This is a strategy of tension. This is their strategy of tension. This is their strategy of tension. This. Aimless, rootless, realistic, dead-eyed.
You're listening to the Ungagged podcast. I'm Em Dehaney, and this is my poem, Dominoes. In the chaos of dominoes, still you stand, tiny man, with your grabby hands and your urine-stained tan. When will you break and be burned at the stake of the fake? News is all it takes. Witch hunt? Witch hunt? This cunt, this brouhaha, is just deflection from his defection. This infection. From the top of the hill to the city, it's a pity that the bear never sleeps. Like those sharks on TV, dead eyes, always moving, always winning, just keep swimming. What was I saying? A school, a wall. Will Humpty Dumpty have a great fall? Or is it business as usual? Pull the hair plug, drain the swamp. Swing your limp dicks in the air like you just don't care. Shoot your guns, have your funds. Domino runs out of many. One.
First time ever I saw your face, I thought the sun rose in your eyes, and the moon and the stars. The gifts you gave to the night and the endless sky. The first time ever I kissed your mouth, felt the earth move in my hand, like a trembling heart. I've been kept a bird that was there. I command my love the first time ever I lay with you. I felt your heart so close to mine. Joy would fill the earth and last till the end of time, my love. First time ever I saw your face.
Stick me gaily on I go, healing toe for toe. I'm invited, I'll no go. Day Don Harry's wedding. Watch the yuns fill up a tune, Markle's stoating in her goon. Pass the plebs all bowing doon, and check a state a Harry. Step me gaily on I go, healing toe for toe. If I'm invited, I'll no go, tae Don Harry's wedding. Ah, hello everybody, Redrave here. We're a wee windy into the People's Republic of my street, where some of us is no so much digital revolutionaries, but more like digi-eye revolutionaries. While I record this, there's only one thing on my mind. Russia? Donald Trump? The chaos that is Brexit? Australians making their boss all rough? Or maybe that was the Russians again? No, though. Chocolate eggs. Aye. It's that time of year again when all Wains is focused on Easter and the thought of a massive imaginary rabbit that creeps about your garden leaving a trail of brown deposits. Or white ones if you're a non-conformist like me. Last year, the Easter Bunny must have been a wee bit late in filling his basket, and I ended up with a couple of boiled eggs wrapped in tinfoil and a big bar of Galaxy. Dad was working a lot of night shifts that week, and he said maybe the Easter Bunny was the same, working into the wee hours to feed his squad of bouncy wains. Hopefully he's more organised this year. Dad says he probably learnt his lesson last time, and I'm going to get a massive egg this year. Yes! Well, I hope you and yours have a good one, if that's your thing. And I'm off to wire into a couple of hot cross buns. I mean, what can go wrong?
Welcome to another trip down the rabbit hole from your clever comic cunt in Chattanooga, Tennessee, USA, author of the blog Notes from the Ninth Circle. Just call me Chuck. Today's piece is an abridged repeat of one I gave back in September. Its central thesis is that the Galilean prophet Isho Nasrayah, better known as Jesus Christ, was crucified at the time of Sukkot, or Feast of Tabernacles, rather than at Pesach Matzot, or the joint festivals of Passover and Unleavened Bread. Fans like me of the American TV show Supernatural may wonder from where the motif of the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse seen in seasons 4 and 5 comes, and while some may know it comes from the Book of Revelations in the New Testament, you may not understand why there are four. The reason there are four horsemen is because they are the counterparts to the four craftsmen of Jewish eschatology. The four horsemen properly and most correctly are tyranny, war, famine, and plague. The craftsmen, on the other hand, their counterparts in Jewish eschatology are Elijah, the Messiah ben Joseph, or also called the Messiah ben Ephraim, the Messiah ben David, or Messiah ben Judah, and the righteous priest, or Messiah ben Levi. According to Jewish eschatology, Elijah will appear at Pesach Matzot, or Passover Unleavened Bread, in the spring. The Messiah ben Joseph will appear at Shavuot, or Pentecost, in the summer. And the Messiah ben David and the righteous priest will appear together at Sukkot, or Tabernacles, in the early fall. That is a very simplified version. To the native population of Palestine in the first century, Jesus was not a Jew. At the time, to a native resident of Palestine, the word Jew signified a native resident of Judea, which is why the writers of the Gospel of John refer to Jesus' opponents as Jews, seemingly not including him. Jesus was a Galilean, and in the milieu of first century Palestine, Galileans were held in little better regard by their fellow Jews as a whole than Samaritans. So, for native ethnic subgroups in Palestine, we have the Judeans, Galileans, and Samaritans. The other two major subgroups were the Idumeans and Pereans. For simplicity here, I'll use the word Jews for all four different subgroups collectively of Jews, the Judeans, Galileans, Idumeans, and Pereans, and Judeans for the specific ethnic subgroup from Judea. The palms carried by pilgrims in procession on what to traditionalists was the first Palm Sunday was and still are a feature of Sukkot, but not Pesach Matzot or any other occasion. Likewise, through the entire group of Hallel Psalms is recited daily throughout all festivals. Those are Psalms 113 through 118. The singing of the two verses upon which the cries of the people on the so-called first Palm Sunday are based, Psalms 118 verses 25 through 26, was unique to one of the rites of Sukkot. That rite took place every day of the festival after the additional sacrifices for the festival that took place and which take place after the first of the ordinary daily sacrifices. There were two of these, one at 9 in the morning and one at 3 o'clock. When the priests and Levites would then lead the congregation in circumambulation around the altar, waving palms as they processed. And this waving of the palms, that was limited to Sukkot, just like all this other stuff. The blood and the water, which the Gospels portray pouring out of Jesus' side when pierced with a spear, specifically in the Gospel of John and in some early copies of the Gospel of Matthew, represent another motif tying his crucifixion to Sukkot. At dawn, Levites would lead a procession of the congregation present at the temple to the Pool of Siloam south of the compound, with the congregation singing and waving their palms while the Levites played instruments. When they returned with a pitcher of water, the officiating priest would take it and a pitcher of wine and pour them simultaneously over the altar. Although this pouring of liquid over the altar took place at that same time every day, wine was poured over the altar, but the water was confined to Sukkot. It was never used at any other time. In Jewish eschatology, this rite symbolized the Messiah ben David. Finally, the festival of Sukkot is an eighth-day festival, seven for the festival of Sukkot itself, and one more at the end, which is a separate but attached festival called Shemini Atzeret. And that timeline matches the timeline of the week of the Passion as presented in the Gospels much better, beginning on Palm Sunday and ending with Easter Sunday. The central importance of Sukkot vanished with its festivities at the thorough destruction of the temple and its compound, along with the entire city of Jerusalem, after it surrendered to the Roman armies in 70 CE at the end of the Great Jewish War. To diaspora Jews and eventually Palestinian Jews, as well as Gentile converts to Judaism and later Christianity, for those whose followers claimed as the Messiah ben David to have come to Jerusalem at the time of Sukkot rather than Passover would make no sense, which is how the whole story got transferred several months ahead in the year. The imagery of Palm Sunday, however, was just too good to discard along with the rest of the story, so it was retained out of place. Our day will come, inshallah. Keep the faith. Peace out.